Ralph Shulman. I just want to remind people that when Watergate went public and went really big, it was only when the Daniel Ellsberg papers were read in Congress. So think about your congressman and your senator. You know, in other words, as soon as we can get any of this official material read in Congress, suddenly it takes on a whole level of officialness.
You mean read into the congressional record?
Yes, read into the congressional record. Ralph, with no further delay, we'd like to hear from you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry you have to bear with my laryngitis, but I'll try to make myself heard. Let me say, first of all, that we have to understand and examine and look at the events of 9/11 not as sui generis, not as something unique or distinct or separate or new with respect to the conduct of policy by those who have structural power and control of our society. One of the functions of that commission was to assimilate antecedent such events to that demonic other. All of that effort by that commission was to look at 1993 or the bombing of the embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam or the attack upon the coal or the blowing up of the La Belle discotheque in Berlin, and all of those were again assimilated to the category of terror, when in each instance they were false flag operations involving the United States authorities with ample evidence on the record with respect to that. And I have to emphasize in this regard that those events which were templates for the events of 9/11 proceeded under a prior administration. Nairobi and Dar es Salaam were under Clinton. 1993 was under Clinton. The same apparatus of implementation was present irrespective of what nominal administration is in office without power. So we have to be clear about the systemic nature of these events. In this regard, let me just make reference here to a prior such operation, namely the execution of the Kennedy brothers. I'm not even going to speak here about the murders of Martin Luther King Jr. or of Malcolm X and of countless others who are witnesses or material figures in relation to those events. I mean, there's a four-volume book by Penn Jones called Forgive My Grief, which simply itemizes the material witnesses in relation to the Kennedy execution who died and were killed in a space of 18 months. So I think we have to be clear about what we're addressing here, which is a systemic issue. It has to do with preserving the power of a besieged handful of people in control of a system in terminal decay. And in understanding that, we also, I think, have to look at a particular aspect of what it means to carry out education, agitation, and struggle against these particular kinds of crimes, this criminal conspiracy, which is the operation of power and its structure in this society. 1% controlling more than 95% of the population combined. As Bill Pepper cited, a particular statistic that I like to cite and have done over the years, Robert Townsend's documentation about what he called the 5,000 who have control over what he called the commanding heights of the U.S. economy, averaging 14 corporate directorships per person. Who has, as Townsend, who is the head of Avis and American Express, said, look upon this country as their own private whorehouse and treat each president as their private towel boy. That has to be borne in mind. With respect to the execution of Kennedy, massive evidence. Evidence as massive as we are now finding it in relation to 9/11. And many people had the expectation, I would call it an illusion, that out of a congressional investigation or some formal juridical arena, we would find redress in this regard. You know, paradoxically, when we want reform or change or concessions on the part of the rulers, they are never obtained by suborning ourselves to their decisions or pleading for these things or asking for them or coming before them. Well, on the contrary, as Clarence Thomas used to say, the real Clarence Thomas of ILWU Local 10, we didn't get to vote by voting. It's only when a movement is independent of control of the established order, when people are mobilized, when they are fearful of the extent to which a movement is escaping their control, that concessions are made in the form of reforms, And the moment that movement is deflected and reabsorbed and co-opted and channeled and contained, why do they take the reforms back? Concessions are retrieved. They're always probing for those who have control to see how far they can go, what can it get away with, and how they can accomplish demobilizing and demoralizing their victim population. Specifically, I want to cite the example of Fletcher Prouty. Many of you may be aware of Colonel Prouty, who had been in the Eisenhower administration the liaison between Central Intelligence and the White House for the implementation of programs of assassination, political assassination. That was his desk. Well, Prouty had been reassigned on the eve of the Kennedy execution to New Zealand for some nominal operations that had to do with the South Pole and what have you. Yes? When the Kennedy execution unfolded, he recognized the MO, notably because the newspapers in New Zealand and Australia were carrying the information about the culpability of Lee Harvey Oswald prior to the event. There was a time gap. Prouty, I have to point out to you, was called before the Church Committee, Frank Church, the Senate Committee on Assassinations and what have you. Now, of course, Church had himself prior been in the Central Intelligence Agency. But what Fletcher described was that when he appeared before the Church Committee, and prior to that going into the offices where it was being administered, there he saw amongst those who were ascending, establishing its agenda, were three of his own functionaries, aides in the program of assassination with which he had been associated in his Eisenhower years. The plug uglies, they were essentially running the operation. What we found with the Rockefeller Commission, or for that matter, the congressional committee that Robert Blakey was assigned to conduct, they wanted to obtain what we knew, establish where that evidence came from. Who were the witnesses who were coming forward with that? To shut it down. This is not an arena, I suggest to you, where we will find redress. What we did with respect to the crimes against the population of Vietnam was to establish a tribunal, yes, but on the model of what you've heard here before, namely a grand jury. We did not assume that we were in a position with state power to bring in a juridical indictment. We couldn't establish arbitrarily an adversary proceeding. This would, in effect, have been a mock trial. You cannot compel, we don't have subpoena power, witnesses to come forward or obligate them to select lawyers in their own defense. This is not a useful method of procedure. We had a prima facie case, massive evidence of great crime, nor did we affect some putative objectivity that none of us can lay claim to possessing. Everyone is shaped and formed by their own experience, their own predilections, their own class position. Every judge, every jury, are people shaped and formed by... The only criterion is the availability of the evidence, the massiveness of the evidence, and its verifiability by others. Some putative objectivity which has never existed is a futile pursuit. In fact, it's only a means through which the captive media seek to impugn the activity of those who were engaged. If you were not concerned about... You talk about crime... McNamara, in this recent film, The Fog of War, acknowledged as well about 2.7 million people were killed in Vietnam. What is that, about 29 million people in the United States equivalent? I mean, these genocidal pursuits are rooted deeply within a structure of imperial control and power, the pursuit of exploitation of resources and cheap labor, and the imposition of military occupation to achieve those ends. And above all, the addiction to war. It's an economy that since the 30s is unable to escape its dependence upon arms production and pursuits. Trillions upon trillions of dollars. You can't... What about the $1 trillion a year, which is an official estimate, that is involved in the drug traffic that enters the United States? Every principal bank is monitoring and laundering and dealing with these proceeds. You can't distinguish this from the workings of finance capital. It represents majority control, general dynamics. major institutions of the society. It's a deeply systemic issue that we're addressing here. So what I'm suggesting with respect to this is that our task is both an educational and agitational one, to reach out to a population under siege, to bring before people the evidence that we have been involved in adducing, because, as it were, anybody who in the face of such evidence affects a sort of, wouldn't it be nice to find out what is happening in Vietnam? That's an agnostic position that is totally incompatible with the evidence which is so massive and in everybody's presence. No, that is a criterion for not being entitled to be involved in pursuit of these issues. If you affect an agnostic posture with reference to the events of 9/11, you are indicating that you are involved in what the Jesuits call invincible ignorance, because all of the major media have already, in their own pages, provided a huge documentation about the nature of these events. The Wall Street Journal is a principal source for the relationship between the Bushes and the Clintons and Jackson Stevens and Osama bin Laden's family and the investments thereof. The BCCI and the drug trafficking, and all of this is in the Houston Chronicle, the Boston Chronicle and Sentinel, and the Wall Street Journal ad nauseam. The reference to the hands of intelligence all over the patsies who were established, the putative hijackers. Now, it's the Washington Post, Knight Ridder newspapers, and Newsweek. Yeah, Brooks Air Force Base, Maxwell Air Force Base, crypto security clearance, Pensacola Naval Station as their address, Monterey's Defense Language School, Monterey, California. This
Maxwell
is the
Maxwell Air Force.
This is the mainstream newspapers and that have provided this documentation over a space of time. We ferret it out. We draw the implications of this. All of us do that. But there's no single member of Congress, no single member of the media who can say to me that they're not aware of this data. It's all over the place. It's established data.
Ralph, we only have a few minutes left, and I'd love to hear about the International Tribunal that you're working on.
Well, the International Tribunal, I'm not working on an International Tribunal, frankly. I mean, I was Secretary General of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina. And time is, we don't have the time. I had, during those years, given a description of what it was that went into the forming of this tribunal and the premises with which we were working. And the basic point I wanted to make to you about that is that we did not affect or pretend to have any juridical objective here. No, it was an agitational objective, as we had very imposing people with enormous credentials, both in terms of their intellectual contribution and their competence to examine the bacteriological weaponry that was being used, the impact on dikes and on the agricultural infrastructure, the presence of torture, the genocidal nature of that war, its purpose and such. We have people with great authority and competence to document and to establish and to demonstrate this reality. But that was by way of presenting a massive prima facie case to the court of public opinion, for the purpose of mobilizing people for a political struggle, for a struggle that would challenge those in authority around this reality. And I think that, as with your description of the grand jury, and so with respect to any tribunal, I don't myself think that the courts are going to be an arena in which we will obtain redress in this regard, because the nature of the court system and indeed of the what passes for Congress is such that there is a vested and necessary interest in not permitting that to occur. We've seen this repeatedly and inevitably. But that, it's not to say that you don't use them as an arena with which to agitate, through which to agitate, but redress from these bodies will not be fast in coming. With respect to Watergate itself, Watergate is, as we are increasingly aware, is an inside job. The setting up of the Nixon people, this is part of the internecine struggle within the class about various events. Patrick Fitzgerald is what? With Chertoff, he's involved in the FBI office of New York in the sting operation that was the bombing of 1993 in the World Trade Center. Ahmad Ali Salem is an Egyptian intelligence operative, a high-level FBI operative, who is wearing a wire when he goes into the mosque of the blind Egyptian sheikh. This is something that's set up by design. Chertoff is deeply involved with that. Chertoff was representing, by the way, one of the principal financiers and a conduit for CIA funding of the Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda apparatus. He did this for years. Patrick Fitzgerald is the point man with respect to the indictments and the prosecution around the Nairobi and Dar es Salaam bombings. But Ali Mohammed and these people, I mean, it's all over the San Francisco Chronicle and any number of places. These guys are long. Ali Mohammed is Fort Bragg, Central Intelligence, FBI. He's providing for CIA, the bodyguards for Osama bin Laden. All the hands of intelligence are all over these events. What is Fitzgerald about right now with these indictments? This is relevant to what we're discussing here. He's basing himself upon what is called the Lew Wolf Act, namely making it a federal crime to out the what Harrison Salisbury called the gentleman killers of the CIA. The gentleman killers of the CIA are not very gentlemanly. You know, I mean, Valerie Plame was very... much known for her adeptness with an AK-47, which she was doing in North... She was not an administrator, functionary in North Africa. She was operating death squads in North Africa. Joseph Wilson was the point man for Bush Sr. with respect to setting up Saddam. Not April Glasby, the diplomatic cover. Wilson was talking to Tariq Aziz and Saddam about, you know, you've got a grievance here. Now, the Kuwaiti emir, he moved his arbitrary borders 900 square kilometers north. He's sitting on the edge of the Rumel oil fields, the largest in Iraq. He bought the Santa Fe Drilling Corporation in Alhambra, California for $2.3 billion. Scowcroft is on the board of directors. Mossbacker's on the board of directors. Talk about a kleptocracy. He then sucks out about $14 billion of Iraqi oil with his horizontal drilling equipment. And now... Wilson is saying to Saddam, you've got a grievance here. You should rectify that border. He says, with our Navy in the Gulf and your troops rectifying this, he said, we'll arrange cheap oil. We're setting him up. But I raise this with you because these people who are being celebrated in the Nation Institute and on Pacifica, Amy Goodman and what have you, these are people who are elements of the means through which the policies of predation are inflicted. You know what they did in Iraq with respect to the Gulf War, the magnitude of devastation? You know, in the space of 9 weeks, more firepower from the air than all of World War II. Country of 17 million people with 1/10,000th the military capacity of the United States. These things... Pardon me?
Depleted uranium was part of that.
Well, depleted uranium, yes, ancillary, I have to tell you, devastating though it is. I mean, high-flaring magnesium bombs that suck the oxygen out of the air. Gossamer elements that, when ignited, create a firestorm of such a magnitude. No, everything is devastated. You should look at the report of Matti Ahtisaari, the Undersecretary of the United Nations. I mean, the shock about this country is totally devastated by this air bombardment. And the air bombardment is the little beginning. This is a procedure in which both of the nominal parties are deeply involved. You know, what did Madeleine Halfright tell us with respect to the United Nations sanctioned blockade of that country? 1.5 million civilians dead, 750,000 children through the blockade alone. Was it worth it? She was asked. She said, yes, it was. These are people who are deeply embedded in the preservation of a system of control. So in documenting this, in demonstrating this, in seeking arenas in which to make it available to our population through tribunals, tribunals are in essence a means of grand jury-like presentment to our population for purposes of mobilizing people in their own self-defense to address this criminal system as such. And if we look to the perpetrators as an arena of redress, we will be pissing up a rope, quite frankly. I think it's essential to bear in mind what is the nature of our task here. which is to build a constituency for a political struggle, for a political instrument of change, to sweep this entire oligarchy, this corporate ruling class, out of control of our institutional life, because there is a root incompatibility between any kind of democratic entitlement and a system which is dependent upon its eradication, its nullification, and its being emptied of any content, form without substance. So this question of providing an agitational arena through tribunals and hearings, yes, it's a very important task for us to undertake, but I suggest to you that it's a political task. It's a mobilizing task. It's an agitational task. And that's where our political focus should be, because we have a vast population that is the primary target of this. All of these terrible things, from depleted uranium to the bioweaponization of bacteria and the altering of genomes and the creating of the next pandemic, this is targeting our population. It has for 40 years. We have promised that these next pandemics are inexorable and will be unleashed, and they're in the process of being unleashed. They have been. That's what a criminal system in terminal decay is compelled to do. We understand this through looking at the data, for seeing how, from our own experience, these things are put together and how they work. So, yes, let's assemble evidence. Let's mobilize people around that understanding. Let's provide, as it were, instruments for dissemination of this information. We certainly want to engage people of some prominence in this process to the extent that we can, but the institutional arena is not likely to be one friendly to our pursuits. That is an arena for absorption, for deflection, and for shutting things down from our lived experience. Let's go forward in doing this with respect to building a genuine and ongoing movement for fundamental change. Thank you.